I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There is intense speculation this morning as to the fate of Saddam Hussein, his family, and senior leaders. At the daily Central Command briefing in Qatar, Brigadier General Vincent Brooks explained why that complex in the affluent section of Baghdad was hit with 4 tons of high-tech explosives.
We had credible information that indicated that there was a regime leadership meeting occurring yesterday. While it's not useful to get into any speculation on who might have been present at that meeting, what we will say is that we had an opportunity to attack that particular regime leadership meeting.
The crater left by the blast is 60 feet deep. It will be some time before anyone is able to determine who may have died in that blast. President Bush is in the midst of a meeting in Belfast with British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Bush was asked what he knew about the fate of the Iraqi leader.
I don't know whether he survived. The only thing I know is he's losing power.
And the president had a forceful new image for reporters, which he's using to explain that the Iraqi regime is being changed.
The only thing I can tell you is that grip I used to describe that Saddam had around the throats of the Iraqi people are loosening. I can't tell you if all 10 fingers are off the throat, but finger by finger is coming off. And the people are beginning to realize that. It's important for the Iraqi people to continue to hear this message. We will not stop until they are free.
This hour, we will talk about the freedom that U.S. troops currently have to move around Baghdad, how that changes the war. We'll also be catching up on news of chemical weapons discoveries in that country. Connection listeners, there are still questions about what's happening in the Iraqi capital. Is the pursuit of Saddam Hussein key to ending Iraq's military opposition? How big a factor is the hunt for those chemical weapons at this point? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we will be joined later this hour by an expert on chemical weapons and a retired Marine colonel with insights into the latest of the battle. We want to go first, though, to Baghdad to hear from John Danishevsky. He is a correspondent with the Los Angeles Times. He says there's been very little information there about the fate of Saddam Hussein.
That's true. Unusually, yesterday afternoon, they allowed a group of about 50 journalists to go out and take a look at the crater. They were presenting it as another case of civilian casualties. It was an enormous hole. I wasn't there, but Los Angeles Times photographer Carolyn Cole was there. And it was an enormous hole. It destroyed 4 houses. It certainly didn't look like the run-of-the-mill stray bomb. It looked like something that was targeted. But it was only hours later that we heard this report that perhaps President Hussein and his sons were there.
Tell me what you're seeing in the city blocks around the Palestine Hotel, how close the battle is to you.
Well, it's very close. We are just directly across the river from the presidential compound. It comprises several palaces, government buildings, and it reaches up for about a mile to the Jumeirah Bridge, which crosses into the main central square of Baghdad, Tahrir Square. Now, all night long, well, I should say from about 4:30 this morning, fighting erupted, and it was in front of us as though we were watching an IMAX film. Bombs going off, flames shooting in the air, and gradually, over the course of about 8 hours, the fighting, the center of the fighting moved northward towards that bridge. There were tremendous explosions. That's when the cameraman for Al Jazeera television was killed because they had an office in that area. The net result was that U.S. tanks pulled out onto that bridge and shot towards the center of the city where the Iraqis were shooting back at them, and basically just cleared that bridge. So the bridge is under the guns of the U.S. Army right now.
Were you in the Palestine Hotel, John, when it was struck itself?
Well, thankfully I was not. I was across the street in a hotel just opposite called the Sheraton. Of course, we heard the loud explosion and the shaking. And not too long afterwards, they were bringing the injured journalists down and taking them to hospitals.
Have you had a chance to go to the hospitals? We have seen a lot of the pyrotechnics that you're describing, but it's not clear what the level of civilian casualties is. Have you had a chance to look into that?
Yes, I've just come back from the hospital. It was a gruesome, distressing scene. So many ambulances were coming every 2 or 3 minutes, pulling out horrifically injured people. Now, they're not all civilians, not by any means. There are soldiers also, but some of the people are clearly children, women, older men who seem to have been caught in the crossfire. And there was quite an angry mood. In fact, we had to move out of the hospital because the people who were with us were afraid that the people there were so angry that they would do harm to us.
Now, we were hearing reports even before this war began that the hospitals were low on supplies, in part as a result of the sanctions. Are you hearing that, seeing evidence of that?
They are. I think they were adequately supplied when the war began, but they're rapidly using up their stores. For instance, they've run out of body bags, and bodies were just laying out back without any wrapping on them because they didn't have any more body bags. They also are using up their surgical tools. Antibiotics, anesthesia, they still have, but it's running low. Their supplies are running lower. And the doctors are working 24 hours. I talked to one orthopedic surgeon who said he's done 12 operations today already, and it's 5:30 in the afternoon here.
John, as the fighting in Baghdad continues, I'm curious to know whether or not in your own ability to move around the city, whether you're working under the same measure of control and monitor that you have been since you got there. I know it may be a difficult question. If you'd rather not answer, just say so. But I'm wondering whether or not you're seeing any more freedom for journalists such as yourself to move around the city.
No, rather the opposite. The trend is for less freedom to move around. In fact, right now, about the only place we can go is the hospital. There are fewer drivers available who are willing to drive us around. There are fewer of these minders showing up for work, but we're still under strict orders not to go out on the street without one of these minders. They claim it's for our own protection. In a sense, I think they're probably right because there are a lot of gunmen on the street who might regard any Westerner as a spy if there wasn't a government representative with him.
John, thanks so much for this. Do keep your head down.
Thank you.
John Danishevsky is a correspondent with the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us a few minutes ago from Baghdad. And joining me today from the NPR studio in Washington to discuss the latest news is Jonathan Tucker. He's a senior fellow at the United States Institute of Peace in Washington. He's currently on leave from the Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute. In 1995, Jonathan was a United Nations biological weapons inspector in Iraq. Also joining me is Colonel Robert Work. He's a former Marine Corps colonel and currently a senior analyst with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment in Washington. That's a public policy research institute which focuses on defense planning and transformation. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Dick.
Bob, let me start with you if I can, because I'm fascinated to hear your thoughts on what we know and what we don't know about the way that the air war now appears to be not only just supporting the forces on the ground, but specifically back almost where we were on day one, targeting the leadership in Baghdad. Is this a shift in your mind?
No, not at all. I think the entire campaign up to this point has just been utilizing air and ground together and emphasizing both to gain an advantage whenever we can. And when we have the opportunity to attack leadership targets from the air, we quickly do it.
But this is a part of the story which we will know, I suppose, very little about. I mean, we have to rely on reports from people like John and our own Ann Garrels at the Palestine Hotel based on what they can see, based on what the television cameras are able to show us from the center of the city. But we know nothing about the special operations, the people who are calling in those sort of strikes, I suppose.
That's a great point, Dick. What this is all doing is psychologically really unhinging the Iraqi leadership. The attack on Chemical Ali and Basra and these attacks just press home to the Iraqi leadership that they truly are not safe anywhere. They can't sleep. They can't move. Probably they are under observation from either special operations or CIA teams, and there is air just waiting to attack these emerging targets, as they are called by CENTCOM, and psychologically it must really be causing them problems.
And in the evidence, Bob, that we're seeing from the battlefield, is that borne out by the fact that there appears to be, and again, I'm an amateur here, but there appears to be less command and control in terms of opposing U.S. forces in Baghdad than we've seen so far?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. The initial, it appears as though CENTCOM's initial goals on these probes were really to try to find out what type of defenses they would hold. That first one on Saturday went in and came out. They quickly made the determination, I think, that command and control was really a problem in the city for the Iraqis and that they could move in and stay. And so they cut right into the presidential palace compound and have claimed that for the United States Army.
Now, Jonathan Tucker, your expertise is chemical weapons, and we will turn to that in just a moment. But I'm wondering if you can help us with your own sense of what you're seeing on the television screens, having been based in Baghdad, having spent as much time as you did on those streets. Tell me whether or not you see whether or not we're seeing a clear sense of what's happening in Baghdad.
Well, the focus has been on the regime quarter of Saddam's palaces and the surrounding government buildings, which have been the focus of air attack. I think it's hard to get a sense of the city as a whole from those television images. Mm-hmm. It's a vast, sprawling city, the sort of the color of mud, mostly low-rise masonry buildings with a few tall, rather garish government structures, and then some rather remarkable military monuments that are quite unique in their garishness. But I think we're not getting a sense of the city as a whole. It's a very limited perspective that we're getting from the Palestine Hotel, which is directly across from the government quarter.
Now, we do see those broad avenues with plenty of room for the tanks to maneuver. If we were to get a sense of Baghdad as a whole, what is it that we're missing? If we go, for example, to the east, does it look more like a typical old eastern city with the more narrow streets and the sort of less predictable left and right turns? You know what I mean?
Well, there is a large souk or Arab market in the old part of the city, and that is the most lively and interesting part of Baghdad. And then there are the embankments along the Tigris that are actually very pleasant. There are so-called mazgouf restaurants where they grill fish and the natives sit around and watch their fish being grilled. The souk is a very lively place where you can buy every imaginable type of metalwork or fabric or spices. It's divided up into different areas depending on the type of product being sold there. I just had a sense when I was in Baghdad of a very lively city, people going about their business, and of course that is totally changed now.
All right, Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. When we come back after the break, a focus on what's happening in the search for and the examination of chemical weapons, more on the latest strategy that the U.S. Army and the Marines are using in their fights in the streets of Baghdad, and your thoughts as well. 1-800-423-TALK to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
It did have some preliminary testing done that indicated potentially the presence of some agents. More detailed testing and analysis is required. That's ongoing. Some samples have been moved, and we don't know enough at this point to say that it should be discounted or that indeed we found some weapons of mass destruction available for use.
That was Brigadier General Vincent Brooks from the Central Command briefing this morning in Doha, Qatar, answering what has become a daily question from reporters about evidence of weapons of mass destruction, in particular chemical weapons, this time at a site east of Karbala. Now, earlier in the morning, I talked with Don North. He's a reporter who's with the 101st Airborne Division, a unit which discovered what may turn out to be more evidence of chemical weapons.
Well, the first report we had was a troop of 101st Airborne soldiers in Karbala yesterday. I think it was the 2nd Brigade. They found a suspected chemical shell and, of course, seized it, and it's being analyzed. But last night, a sergeant in the battalion I'm working with was searching a weapons cache, and they came across a strange, rather unidentified device. And when they examined it closely, their chemical detectors went off with a vengeance. And they immediately put on their protective gear and gas masks and seized the object and took it into the 62nd chemical team that is attached to the 101st Airborne.
So I presume that's being analyzed now, Don?
Right, it is. They said it looked something like it was a mine, and obviously sort of an experiment at hooking up a mine to some chemical release device.
Don, you'll know full well why it's so important for the U.S. Army to search out evidence of chemical weapons for their own safety. You'll also know that it has tremendous political importance in terms of the justification of the war. Are the soldiers that you're with specifically looking for chemical weapons at this point, or the discoveries ones they've come across by accident?
No, it's certainly by accident. After the initial fighting here in An-Najaf, the duties went to searching buildings for weapons caches, destroying weapons and ordnance and bombs. And so there's no real special search for chemicals. Although we do have the chemical unit, the 67th chemical unit attached to us, and they've set up detox or decontamination station at this small airport adjacent to the town. So they're ready to wash down any troops who might come in contact with chemical weapons.
That's Don North. He's a reporter with the 101st Airborne Division, and I spoke with him just before we went to air here. A reminder of who's with me on the program today. Bob Work is a former Marine Corps colonel, senior analyst with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment in Washington, D.C. Jonathan Tucker is a senior fellow at the United States Institute of Peace in Washington. Back in 1995, Jonathan was with UNSCOM as a biological weapons inspector in Iraq. And Jonathan, as you listen to the description of what Don says they're looking at, I'm a little bit lost, I have to confess, to know, you know, how soon we're going to get the sort of confirmation that this is this and that is that. I mean, based on what you're hearing and what you're reading, how far along are you in making up your mind about what's being discovered?
Well, I think we have to be cautious, because with these preliminary tests, there is a high incidence of so-called false positives. That is, there appears to be a detection that later turns out to be false. And the reason is that these initial detection or battlefield detection systems, such as indicator paper or the M256 kit, which is a little chemistry set on a card, the chemical agent monitor, which is a handheld detection device for chemical weapons, all of these systems are designed to err on the side of false positives, so that if troops put on their gas masks unnecessarily, there's no harm in it. But of course, if you don't detect a chemical attack or chemical contamination and troops are exposed, the consequences are very severe. So these preliminary types of detection systems tend to result in false positives, and they have to be confirmed with more reliable analytic systems. So, for example, the find in Karbala, samples have been taken from the barrels of chemicals and are being transported down to mobile laboratories in southern Iraq, where a more conclusive analysis will be conducted using a technique known as mass spectrometry, which is a highly reliable analytic technique.
Now, when Don talks about, as he did, the what may be the discovery of some sort of mine-looking device with that set off their own chemical weapons detector, it got me wondering whether or not there are ways of distributing chemical weapons beyond what we've been led to think about so far? Because really, up until this point, Jonathan, it's been all about tipping missiles in the battlefield with chemical weapon warheads. Are there other ways of using the chemical weapons which could come into play in the sort of close quarters we're seeing in Baghdad or elsewhere in the country?
Well, there are a wide range of delivery systems for chemical weapons, ranging from aerial bombs to spray tanks that would be carried by tactical aircraft, to various types of tube and rocket artillery, regular artillery shells fired from howitzers, or artillery rockets fired from multiple rocket launchers, and then finally, mines. Chemical mines have been in existence for many, many years. The United States produced chemical mines, as did the Soviet Union, when we had an offensive chemical warfare program. So that would be nothing new if in fact, that is what has been discovered.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, if you have questions about the chemical weapons part of the story that we're trying to keep track of this hour, 1-800-423-8255. Bob Work, I'm interested in your thoughts on how the Marine commanders will be preparing their people as they move through the east of Baghdad, as they move into areas close to people. Will they be relaxing their concern about chemical weapons or keeping their alerts quite high?
There was a report last night with one of the embedded reporters with the Marines that for the first time they were told that they could take off their chemical suits. That would indicate a pretty high level of confidence on the side of their commanders that the time of maximum danger for these type of attacks have passed. But I'm sure that any intelligence indications that there may be preparations would be followed up quickly. The Marines are approaching on a little different type of terrain, military terrain, than the Army is. The Army has these real broad avenues of approach into this complex than we've seen their freedom of action. The Marines are actually moving towards Rashid Military Airport. The reports are that they have actually seized it. They're going through very old neighborhoods with just a warren of alleys and small kind of urban sprawl. And it's extremely nerve-wracking on these young 17, 18, 19, 20-year-old Marines as they try to clear through this area, trying to identify friendlies from non-friendlies moving forward. So I believe that the commanders are trying to keep them on edge and make sure that they can accomplish their objectives.
Now, help me, if you can, Bob, sort through the images, because most of what we see, and we're restricted by what the photographers, both the still photographers and the television photographers can show us, is the Army divisions in their armory, in their armor, I should say, and Marines, in many cases, on foot. Is that an accurate view of exactly how they're moving into the city?
I think generally that's probably true. As I said, that with these broad avenues of approach on the western side of the river, the Tigris, the Army is using them to push large columns of armor and armored personnel carriers. There was a report of 70 tanks and 70 Bradley infantry fighting vehicles, for example, the vehicles that you see quite often on the screen. The Marines on the other side are to the east of the city in more slum-type area, and they are not as heavily armored as the Army. And the areas that they're going through are really require a lot of dismounted Marines, a lot of dismounted troops, because it is just so broken up, a lot of low buildings, very poor neighborhoods, and dismounted troops are extremely good in these areas.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to first to Fairfield, Iowa. Alan's on the line. Hi, Alan.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for the opportunity. My question is related to this discussion in that we say that we're going into Iraq to liberate and help the Iraqi people, and I think finding chemical weapons, weapons of mass destruction, is very important. At the same time, it's my understanding that we're using hundreds of thousands of tons of spent uranium armaments, and that these have a long-lasting effect, destructive effect upon the environment and the health of people who have to live in these environments, on the groundwater and the air and the earth. And I just ask your experts to comment on the effect of spent uranium, and also maybe comment how we can be saying that we are helping the Iraqi people, while at the same time, the means we're using to do that may be destroying their environment. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Alan. Jonathan, maybe you can help a little bit. This is the depleted uranium debate. It's certainly not a new one, but it's something that's been brought back into focus this particular time. I know from my own earlier travels in Iraq that even at the end of the 1990s, and you probably heard it while you were there as a weapons inspector, people were complaining about the use of depleted uranium in the no-fly zones and in the first Persian Gulf War. Do we know any more about it at this point? Are we any, or is the debate still where it was 5-10 years ago?
My impression is that the debate is still raging. The concern about depleted uranium is not about any residual radioactivity, but rather the fact that this is a heavy metal that has toxicity of in various physiological systems. Its effects, I believe, are still a matter of debate among medical specialists. But there is growing concern about its environmental and health effects. The problem is that it's an extremely effective weapon for penetrating armor. It's used both by the A-10 Warthog, which is close air support aircraft that can target tanks, as well as in tank munitions for tank-on-tank engagements. And because this material is so dense and so heavy, has an enormous inertial force, can penetrate even extremely thick armor. And so for that reason, the Army has been very reluctant to give up this weapon, which it finds so effective. But I think the growing concerns about the health impact and the environmental effects are causing many people to question whether this weapon is acceptable, and I think the Army should consider alternatives that perhaps have the same level of or close to the same level of military effectiveness, but without the long-term environmental and health consequences.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Bob Work, you've done a lot of liaison work in your career between the Congress and the Department of Defense and the White House, and I'm interested in knowing where you place this debate over depleted uranium. Are the soldiers in the field also concerned about the possible effects on them for being, you know, on the firing end of these weapons?
I'm not certain. The one thing I can say is that a lot of the Iraqi armor in this war has been killed by precision-guided weapons from the air. The large armored battles that some people might have expected just simply have not materialized. Therefore, I think that the amount of depleted uranium being used is probably far less than people might think. So I'm not certain how the soldiers feel about this. I believe, as Jonathan said, that they want to, when they go into battle, they want to have the biggest overmatch possible. And if they have a weapon that will give them an advantage in battle, I think most of them would say they would like to have it.
All right. Well, we'll no doubt hear more about that. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go now to Stoddard, New Hampshire, and Kevin's joining us. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Not bad. First of all, Colonel Work, I'd like to say hi to you. I actually served under you with 5th Battalion, 11th Marines. You would probably remember me best as the guy that appropriated a Humvee.
It's good to hear from you.
Okay.
How's that Humvee running there, Kevin? Is that still going okay?
Well, I gave it back to the guards.
Oh, okay.
My question, actually, for you, Colonel Work, an artillery officer, I heard reports a lot, and actually I was concerned whether the 5th Battalion 11th Marines were there, that they're setting up firing positions outside of Baghdad to give support to the troops actually invading Iraq. Is it too dangerous given the premise of our criteria of not injuring, not harming the Iraqi people to put iron on target inside a city environment?
Well, right now, the 5th, believe the 5th Battalion, 11th Marines are there. They probably are on the outskirts. For the other listeners, these are 155-millimeter cannons that can fire a 95-pound shell out to about 30 kilometers. Normally, they would be used in close support of the Marines as they advance. And for example, the Marines advanced on Rashid Military Airport, and it would be quite logical to expect that the artillery would be used in those type of operations. Kevin's point, though, is as the Marines move into the city, the use of 155-millimeter shells will be used only when required, I believe, to help out the Marines in contact. But they will not be used to make big barrages inside the city.
And this is a part of what everybody was discussing in advance of these moments, and that was the restrictions on the edge that the U.S. military has as it moves closer and closer to civilians.
Yes, that's true. And I think that the Central Command has really gone out of its way to emphasize how seriously they're taking this targeting. However, in a city of this size, with this many people and as close in as everything is, once Marines and soldiers are in contact, it's very, very difficult to limit the destruction in the immediate vicinity of the firefight.
Just quick, Kevin, last comment to you. As you watch it and read about it and listen to it, are you getting a sense that those restrictions would slow down the Marines?
Well, what I'm more concerned about is air support is restricted as well. I mean, what kind of support are our Marines getting as they move into the city, and they're more prone to sniper attacks and the warfare of a city environment? It really turns the tide quite a bit. It's a whole different battle.
No, I think you're right about that, and we're certainly seeing evidence of it when we get reports each day from what's happening in Baghdad with the number of casualties, certainly significantly more casualties on the Iraqi side at this point, but still not clear on a day-to-day basis how many Americans have been killed in the fighting. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, we are watching, as are you, the latest in the battlefield from Baghdad, talking about chemical weapons concerns there, also questions about the policy of going after the leadership, whether or not that's still an effective and powerful strategy when the two sides are so close to each other. 1-800-423-TALKS, our number. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, this is The Connection from NPR. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With me on the program, Bob Work, former Marine Corps colonel, nearly 30 years of experience in different command and staff positions, including secretary to the Navy. He's now a senior analyst with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments in Washington. Jonathan Tucker is in the same studio with Bob. He's a senior fellow at the United States Institute of Peace in Washington. He's currently on leave from the Center for Non-Proliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute, and back in 1995 was an UNSCOM biological weapons inspector in Iraq. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go first to Cambridge, Massachusetts. David's on the line. Hi, David.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to bring up the issue of who benefits if chemical weapons are found from a political point of view. I mean, it's certainly not in the Iraqis' benefit to have any chemical weapons found. And I would expect as soon as they knew war was starting that they would have destroyed any caches that they found. Maybe not, but you know, that's sort of a logical point of view, whereas it is definitely in the Americans' interest to find chemical weapons, to rationalize the destruction that's being wreaked upon the Iraqi people. So I think it's important to keep that in mind when considering where caches are found and who finds them.
I guess it's also important, David, to make a distinction between the Iraqi military, the Iraqi leadership, which, as you say, might have it in its best interest if it's not going to use these weapons to make sure that they're not found. And then, of course, the Iraqi civilians who wouldn't mind any further black eyes on their administration, or at least those people who never supported the Ba'ath Party.
That's true, but they're probably not in control of
right.
those caches.
Jonathan Tucker, what about the idea that you know, there's a strong reason just to get rid of them, and I don't know whether or not that means pour them down a hole in the ground or set fire to them or exactly what you do, but what about David's point?
Well, that presumes that there was no intention on the part of the Iraqi military to use these weapons, if only as a last resort. If they had destroyed them entirely before the conflict, which was very clearly approaching, they would, of course, have to forfeit any military options. So I think it is likely that the Iraqis did retain at least some of their chemical arsenal for the possible use against coalition forces.
Is it easy to get rid of? I know that may be a stupid question, but, I mean, what do you do with a 45-gallon drum of VX or sarin or whatever if you do want to get rid of it?
Well, it's very difficult to get rid of it in an environmentally sound manner. And, in fact, the United States and other countries that have large chemical weapons stockpiles that are currently being destroyed are paying tens of billions of dollars to build high-temperature incinerators and neutralization plants for the destruction of these weapons. So destroying them is much more costly than producing them, as we are unfortunately discovering. But in the case of Iraq, during the previous inspection regime, tens of thousands of chemical munitions were destroyed in the early 90s by the UN inspectors, and they used open pit burning and other rather crude techniques. They would just simply take the weapons out into the desert and blow them up. That would be, I believe, unacceptable today on environmental and safety grounds. So, of course, that has never been an issue with the Iraqis. They have always cut corners with respect to health and safety and environmental issues. So, in fact, the Iraqis claim that they destroyed their VX stocks and other extremely toxic chemical stocks simply by digging holes in the ground and pouring these extremely toxic chemicals into the ground. Now, that was never confirmed, but that's what they claim to have done to destroy their weapons.
Just one quick more, Jonathan, before we move on to our next call. You've been a weapons inspector in Iraq, so you've got a better sense of this than any of the rest of us. Is it possible that these chemical weapons or stores of chemicals or whatever may still be there are so well hidden that they may not be found even after there's been, Saddam Hussein is gone and the country is open to this sort of scouring?
It is possible that caches that are, for example, buried in the desert at unmarked sites might never be found. This is a very large country, roughly the size of California. And unless, for example, weapon scientists or other officials come forward with information about where the weapons caches are hidden, it may be extremely difficult to find them all. So I think that is a very real possibility.
All right, David, thanks for that. Let's go to Superior, Wisconsin. Suzanne's on the line. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Kind of a silly question, but I just wanted to bring it to point, and it kind of builds on what the last caller was saying, but I just have a hard time believing that the war in Iraq is strictly based on chemical weapons and or weapons of mass destruction, and I feel like there's a lot of it has to do with oil. And there's been some reference in the news about the Iraqi soldiers having very primitive weapons and compared to, like, what the United States is using, the United States forces are using. And I'm just wondering why, if the Iraqis has these chemical weapons of mass destruction at their hands, why they're not using them. And I'll take my answer off the air.
But don't disappear just yet, Suzanne. I'm
okay.
Curious to know why it is you're a little bit suspicious of whether they have them. We do know from history that Saddam Hussein has used chemical weapons in his war with the Iranians, and there's every indication that he used them against Kurds in his own country as well.
Well, I'm just wondering, I guess, why they're not using them now, then, if they have them so available to them.
All right, good question, Bob Work. It's an interesting one, in part because the demonization of the enemy that takes place before a conflict and the sort of natural preparation of troops to make sure that they're prepared would have everyone believe that, yes, in fact, they have the capacity to use them, but in this conflict at this time with everyone watching, I wonder whether or not there were second thoughts.
I'm not certain, but I think from a military perspective, had the Iraqis thought or contemplated using these, I think they were kind of prevented from doing so for a combination of four factors. One, the initial attacks on the command and control system just really probably put a tremor through the system and severed many of the links which would allow a command to use these weapons to be given. Second, there seems to be, you know, at least anecdotal evidence that a lot of the people in the military are not necessarily following their orders. They're leaving caches on, you know, they're just leaving, they're blending away. The third one is, you know, there is just, we overran, we happened so fast that we got in and among the Iraqi soldiers, I think, much more quickly than they might have contemplated. And they had to think whether or not, if they were going to use these weapons, they would essentially be using them on their own people and their own soldiers. And then, you know, I think in the end, it's just that their calculation is that now it may not be in their best interest to use it. Now they're thinking about regime survival, and if they use these, they'll be hunted down for certain.
And Jonathan, back about 8 years now ago when you were on the search for biological weapons, did you get any insight into the attitude that the leadership in Iraq had as to, you know, whether or not they have a completely different attitude about the viability of something as awful as this compared to the way it's regarded in most of the rest of the world?
Well, I think they saw these weapons, or Saddam saw these weapons, as linked to his ambitions for hegemony over the Persian Gulf, for leadership of the Arab world, for a country that was willing to stand up to Israel and Israel's nuclear capability. And so I think the possession of these weapons was very tightly linked to Saddam's grandiose ambitions. And that explains, I think, why it was so difficult for him to give up these weapons. For 12 years, he was willing to forfeit huge quantities of wealth from the lost sale of oil that resulted from the embargo. If he had been willing to give up the weapons, he could have perhaps retained the capability to reconstitute them at some time in the future. But his defiance of the United Nations, I think, is indicative of how much he valued the possession of these weapons of mass destruction as sort of a symbol of his personal power. These were very much Saddam's arsenal, and I think it was more than the arsenal of Iraq.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Suzanne, thanks a lot for that call. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Jim's been waiting on the line. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. I just recently read a book called The Reckoning by Sandra Mackey.
Okay, I know of it. I have not read it myself.
Okay. Well, in it, she does a very good job bringing us from the point of the beginning of Mesopotamia up to present day Iraq. And during her times when she's talking about the Iran-Iraq war, she talks about how the United States was selling weapons up to both the Iranians and the Iraqis, and I believe we were supporting and possibly selling these weapons of mass destruction to the Iraqis, and even giving them the guidance and the personnel to deploy them. So the question is, why doesn't Saddam Hussein use the weapons? Because he's never used the weapons before. It was the Americans using the weapons in his war. So my question then is, are we going to plant chemical and biological weapons in Iraq and say, aha, we found the smoking gun? Or are they actually going to find them there because they've existed there for more than 10 years? I'll take my question off the air.
Fairly cynical point of view. Bob, maybe you want to take a first shot at that one.
Well, the United States does not use nerve agents in the way that the Iraqis used them on their own people back in the 80s. And in 27 years of service, I have never, ever come across any type of chemical agent other than tear gas, what was called CS. And we didn't train to use it. The only thing we did was train to defend against it. So from my personal perspective, Jim, I just don't believe that your point is valid, that I just cannot believe that the United States would utilize these things in their name or anybody else's names
I think what Jim was saying is that they'd be sort of left in a ditch somewhere surreptitiously, and someone would say, oh, look what we found, in order to make the case. I know that we actually have a number of people who call up and ask that question. I mean, I said it was a cynical way of looking at it, but there's a huge amount of political capital at stake here. Jonathan, any thoughts on this?
Okay. I don't think it's correct to allege that the United States was directly involved in Iraq's use of chemical weapons during the Iran-Iraq War. But we did, we were sort of tilting toward Iraq during that war because we were very concerned that Iran would win and then predominate and dominate the Persian Gulf. So if, out of geopolitical concerns, we provided intelligence assistance and military advice to the Iraqi forces, and that included looking the other way when Iraq proceeded to use chemical weapons on a large scale against the Iranian human wave infantry tactics that were otherwise going to shift the tide of battle in the to the advantage of Iran. So I think there is some complicity of the United States government back in the 80s with respect to providing support, but not actually waging chemical warfare on Iraq's behalf, but rather assisting them to improve their military effectiveness and looking the other way when Iraq made use of chemical weapons.
Bob, a quick last comment from you because we're near the end of the program, but you've mentioned a couple of times on the show today that the tactics of the Iraqi army in Baghdad and in the area around now appear so scattered and so misguided. Does it lead you to believe that this war may be closer to a finish than even some people are thinking?
I'm guardedly optimistic, yes. It just does not appear to be any cohesive or coherent defense of the city. And what we see are more small bands, platoon and company size units moving around. But it would not seem to me that there is going to be a major defense of the city, and that leads me to be very optimistic, hopefully, that this will wind up sooner rather than later.
All right, Bob, thanks for being with us this hour. Retired Colonel Robert Work is a senior analyst with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment in Washington. Jonathan Tucker, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Jonathan is a senior fellow at the United States Institute of Peace in Washington. Earlier in the program, we talked with Dawn North, a reporter with the 101st, John Danishevsky, who's a correspondent with the LA Times. He was reporting from Baghdad. And a big thanks to Simone Steverson at NPR for her help with the program today. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.